Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Syria to speak with Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher, Donatella Rivera, who is behind the lines in the war zone, completing her seventh Human Rights Observer mission inside Syria, where she has documented atrocities, death and destruction. We will discuss the callous targeting of civilian areas and the growing refugee crisis. Then, as one of the wonders of the ancient world, the souk in Aleppo burns, we will speak with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA officer who served in Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon, and has correctly predicted the course of the Syrian civil war since its beginning in March of 2011. We will discuss the increasingly long and bloody surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia and its growing toll on lives, property, and irreplaceable sites of historic heritage. Then finally, we will speak with Mark Perry, who has an article at Foreign Policy, The Entebbe Option, How the U.S. Thinks Israel Might Strike Iran. Following Prime Minister Netanyahu's ultimatum at the UN that Iran will cross his red line in the spring, we will discuss the three possible options of 1. An Israeli commando raid on Iranian nuclear facilities, 2. A massive bombing campaign, and 3. A decapitation strike against Iranian leadership and its military and intelligence Praetorian Guard. Joining us now from Syria is Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher, Donatella Rivera, who monitors human rights crises in the world's hotspots, one of the very few journalists or human rights monitors who have been on the ground in Syria in recent months. She goes where few are able or willing to venture. In the last year alone, she's led Amnesty's research missions in Libya, where she was under fire in Misrata, South Sudan's Nuba Mountains, and now in Syria, where she is just completing her seventh Human Rights Observer mission inside Syria, documenting atrocities committed by the Syrian government against its own people. Welcome to Background Briefing, Donatella Rivera.
Hello.
So, Donatella, you're on your way out of Syria, right, heading to the Turkish border, and this is your...
I'm in Syria. I'm just, at the moment, I'm just in Nara, which is relatively near to the Turkish border. I'm in Syria.
Right, and that's why we can talk to you, which we're grateful for. Of course, one of the great tragedies, which we'll be talking about in a little while, is the burning of the souk in Aleppo, which is not a World Heritage Site, but is an extraordinary historic treasure. It doesn't compare to the human suffering, but it makes one realize how deep and ongoing this tragedy is. You've been there in and out of that country behind the lines now on your seventh trip. Do you see any hope, or do you see it just deteriorating?
Hello?
Yeah, do you see things deteriorating? Is that what's happening? It's getting worse?
Very much so. The situation has deteriorated so dramatically over the last 2 months since the Syrian government forces have started to use aircraft and artillery on a daily basis. Basically, since the government forces have been pushed out or have left a large part of the territories, they have resorted to bombing from the air with both aircraft and helicopters and shelling with artillery from a distance. The overwhelming majority of the victims of these attacks are civilian. Just the day before yesterday in the morning, I got to a house which has just been bombed. 7 civilian, 1 elderly man, and the rest, women and children, were killed. And 1 small child, age 3, is now in the hospital fighting for his life. And this is just, you know, this is just the case, one of so many. Not a day goes past without several civilians being killed either in airstrikes or in artillery attacks.
So, Donatella, these people can't get out of the war zone. Is that the reason why they're obviously non-combatants? But with the Syrian government bombing indiscriminately areas where the Free Syrian Army are fighting their troops, is there any way for these people to get out?
The problem is that these people are not really technically in a war zone. These are areas where the combat ended in 2 months ago, where there is no combat anymore. What there is just the bombardment from the air and shelling from afar by government forces. It's as if the Syrian government is wanting to punish collectively the population in the areas which have now come under the control of the armed opposition. There is no safe areas anymore. Hundreds of thousands of people have fled. Obviously, not everybody can leave the country. And for those who remain, there is nowhere safe. A few days ago, I was in the area of Jabal al-Zawiya, which is north of the town of Hama. It's a mountain area, and there are caves. And literally, the population of the villages there spend their entire days in the caves because it's during the day there that there are most frequent bombings. So that's what I saw families doing, just going to the caves early in the morning and staying there all night and then going back home to sleep. Short of the entire population of the country leaving, which is not a realistic proposition because this is a country of 23 million people, there is really nowhere safe anymore for ordinary civilians.
So if the Syrian government is conducting a terror campaign of vengeance and retribution against areas liberated by the Free Syrian Army, and the battles are going on, as we mentioned, in Aleppo, where the ancient souk is burning, and there have been battles inside of Damascus, is there any indication of where the Syrian government will draw the line? Are they prepared to destroy all of these ancient cities?
It's very difficult to know where things are going other than in what seems to be a very bad direction, because the situation has worsened steadily since the beginning of the uprising. You know, it began with peaceful demonstrations, and for months we saw peaceful demonstrators being shot with live bullets. And then, you know, there was the period of the incursions by the army, and now it's the bombing and shelling from afar, and now it's by far worse than it was a few months ago, because really there is nothing that anybody can do to protect themselves from bombs being dropped from the air or artillery shells being lobbed from 15 kilometers away. At the moment, there seems to be, on the one hand, the Syrian government shows no intention of changing course. I mean, if anything, from what we've seen in the past 2 months, they have increased the attacks, which are indiscriminate because they are using imprecise weapons which are meant for the battlefield and which should never be used in civilian residential areas, but which are used in residential areas, with disastrous consequences for the civilian population. And on the other hand, we see an international community which is completely paralyzed. There has been no effective pressure exerted on the Syrian government to put a stop to the attacks which cause particular harm to the civilians. Because, as you know, at the level of the UN Security Council, there is a division. And that division has prevented any effective pressure being put. So, unless there is some dramatic change at the level of the international community, the situation looks set to continue to deteriorate even further than it has so far.
Again, I'm speaking with Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher, Donatella Rivera, who is inside the Syrian war zone on her seventh Human Rights Observer mission, documenting atrocities committed by the Syrian government against its own people. Now, what about atrocities committed by the Free Syrian Army? Obviously, this is a bloody civil war. Have you been able to document any atrocities committed by the Free Syrian Army?
There are also human rights abuses being committed by various armed opposition groups. Not all of them are part of the Free Syrian Army. There are many different groups, some of which belong to the Free Syrian Army and other not. The most well-known abuses are those that are committed against soldiers or militia members who are captured by these armed opposition groups and who are often beaten up, in some cases tortured, and in some cases executed. Of course, the same abuses are also continued to be committed by government forces, which have engaged in torture for even long before the beginning of the uprising, but it certainly has become systematic since the uprisings began, and extrajudicial execution also frequently committed by government forces, targeting not only combatants but also peaceful activists. So we have a specific kind of abuses against those who are detained by both sides, ill treatment, torture, and in some cases summary execution, unlawful killings, which are committed by both government forces and armed opposition groups. And then we have the, attacks against the civilian population, which make up by far the largest number of victims. We have not received any information of attacks against civilian, against the civilian population being committed by the armed opposition for now.
So is the Shabia militia on the part of the government, this group that have been you documented earlier when I spoke with you the last time, where they were going through villages and massacring people, innocent civilians, are they still a big part of the mix? Because it seems pretty clear that this has become a sectarian war between the Sunni majority and the Alawite minority, and who it appears the Christian minority also support.
I would be reluctant to use the term civil war, simply because what we are seeing is people being targeted because they are known or perceived or seen as supporting the opposite side. That is the principal reason why people are being targeted. Among the Shabiha militias, there are many Sunni, for example. We've seen some cases where there are allegations that those who committed massacres, such as Hula or some of the other areas, included alongside government forces, militias, pro-government militias from Alawi villages. But those have been, on the whole, isolated cases. In the vast majority of people who've been killed are civilians who have been killed by government forces because they are believed to be supportive of the opposition. And then we see the fight between the both armed sides. Again, it's because of where they stand politically. There are many soldiers and some militia members, pro-government militia members, who are from the Sunni majority. And they are fighting along government on the government side. So, it could be that if the situation continues to deteriorate, that the sectarian element will become increasingly prominent. But until now, I would be very reluctant to use the term civil war, because that's not really what we've seen on the ground. There's certainly been incident of sectarian violence, but for the most part, it's a government which is absolutely bent on suppressing the opposition.
So how would you then describe this division? If it's not a civil war and it's not the Alawites versus the Sunni, what is it?
It's a situation which is not unlike what we've seen in other countries, where part of the population initially peacefully and then by taking up arms rebelled against a government which had a very well established proven record of repression and oppression for many years, and so when part of the population rose up against these practices and demanded change, first peacefully and for many months peacefully, the response of the security forces and armed forces was blind repression. And then, you know, the rest has continued from that.
So it's really about the Assad's family's attitude, in a sense, that they believe it's their divine right to rule this country. They have for the last 50 years, and they simply won't give up power and they won't compromise. That seems to be the situation. But hasn't it become a surrogate war, Donatella Rivera, between Iran and Saudi Arabia in terms of who's supplying arms on both sides?
I think that again we have to work with fact more than with speculation, and both the Syrian government and the Syrian opposition have been trading accusation, each side accusing the other of being, if you will, the puppet of a foreign power, of using foreign fighters, of receiving weapons from abroad. And I mean, all that is there. I mean, there are foreign fighters on both sides, it seems, but they are a tiny, tiny, tiny minority. The weapons that are being used, most of the weapons that I've seen being used are old Soviet era weapons, whether they are missiles or bombs or artillery shells being used by government forces. They're mostly originating from the former Soviet Union, and they're mostly from the 70s, early 80s. Some of them could possibly be from the late 60s. Material that was received a long time ago. As for the opposition, they have until now been fighting mostly with light weapons, and mostly with weapons that they have either bought, especially earlier on, from corrupted army officials and soldiers, and now, more recently, weapons that they have seized from government positions that they have managed to overrun. They have also acquired weapons that have come from outside via Turkey on in the north and via Lebanon from the south. But again, the percentage of the weapons that have come from outside being used on the ground seem to be, for now, still a minority insofar as the opposition is concerned. I mean, on the ground, you know, what we see are still most fighters using Kalashnikovs and some of the heavier machine guns that they have recently seized from government forces. So there hasn't been a very large influx of weapons for now. I mean, there is certainly, you know, each side has its own supporters. But for now, it remains a conflict on the ground, which is fought between government forces and opposition forces, both of which are Syrians in the overwhelming majority.
Well, Donatella Rivera, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and the fact that you're inside Syria in the war zone, and the Syrian government is indiscriminately shelling and bombing areas liberated by the Free Syrian Army where you are. I just hope you keep your head down.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Again, I've been speaking with Amnesty International's lead crisis researcher, Donatella Rivera, who monitors human rights crises in the world's hotspots, one of the very few journalists or human rights monitors who have been on the ground in Syria in recent months. She goes where few are able or willing to venture. In the last year alone, she's led Amnesty's research missions in Libya, where she was under fire in Misrata, South Sudan's Nuba Mountains, and now Syria, where she is on her seventh Human Rights Observer mission inside Syria, documenting atrocities committed by the Syrian government against its own people. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a CIA veteran who served in Syria and who has correctly predicted events since the uprising began in March of 2011. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife, Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Hey, Ian, how's it going?
Well, I know that you must be feeling kind of wretched about what's happening in Aleppo, given what an extraordinary historical heritage site the ancient souk is. It's apparently burning, and it may simply cease to exist.
You know, of course, the human tragedy is foremost in my mind, but Aleppo, the souk, and the medieval city was truly world heritage. There's nothing else like it in the world. In the 80s, I used to walk through it. The smells, the spices, the the food stores. It was dark with the roof was sort of pierced, but it was all very. You just knew you were walking back 1,000 years. And so for this to burn, you know, brings home the reality of Syria for me. There is nothing good about what's happening there.
Well, the Amnesty International's lead researcher who's been is on her seventh trip behind the lines inside of Syria was just telling us that what she sees happening there is that all of the areas liberated by the Free Syrian Army, that the Syrian government is conducting indiscriminate bombing and shelling as a way, out of vengeance, as a way to essentially punish people for this Free Syrian Army, liberate them, if that's the right term.
I wouldn't look at it being punished. It's for the people behind the guns, the Alawites, and a lot of Christians. For them, it's an existential war, and they intend to destroy their enemies and destroy their cities, destroy the country if they have to. They believe their backs are against the wall, rightly or wrongly. They see this led by Islamic militants, and it's just the facts of it just don't really matter right now because they're so paranoid and so vicious and so determined to survive that they have applied what I call Hama rules, which is they destroyed the medieval city of Hama in 1982, February. I visited that, too, and if you want to see real destruction, you should have seen it then. It flattened the entire center of the city, another World Heritage City, simply because of this mentality of a minority, embattled minority, that it's as I said, paranoid. They think the world's coming after them, and they'll just fight and fight and fight. I think if you're realistic about this, darkly realistic, I admit, you just have to efface Syria from the map in your minds. It's not a country anymore. You're going to see the Kurds in the northeast along the Iraqi border, the Turkish border. You're going to see that break off. You're going to see a tendency for Alawites to move back into the Alawite mountain. You're going to see the Syrian insurgents wanting to take the old Sunni cities, and that would be Aleppo, Hama, Homs, and Damascus as well. That's their goal, to reestablish some, you know, order that existed, you know, during the caliphate, which was led by Sunni Muslims. You know, this all seems very primeval when I say it. I know it does. But when you get back in that area, I just came back from the Middle East. This is what they say. And what scares people in the Middle East is the conflicts like Libya and Syria and really Iraq, as we see it still going on. They're spinning off a militant wing of Islam like we've never seen before that is determined, as they call it, to conduct their own crusade against the West, colonialism, and any sort of, you know, 21st century progressivism and humanism. You know, this is very dire predictions what they're saying, and this group is maybe only 10% of people fighting, but they have an enormous influence simply because they're willing to murder and kill, as we saw in Benghazi.
But this is in Syria. Surely, it's not necessarily. It may be a result of Western colonialism and the French divide, legacy of the French divide and conquer notion of putting a minority in charge, which is what the British also did. But the Assads are, of course, a homegrown dictatorship, are they not? So.
Well, I wouldn't look at it as a dictatorship. It's a minority community. No one particularly likes Bashar inside the Alawi community, but that's all there is. And the generals around him, he by default he rules that country, but he's running that country through what's called his promotion. When he went to military academy, it's officers he got to know, and there's maybe 25 of them, and they're conducting the reprisals, the shellings, running the air force, and the rest of it. So it's more of a military junta. And, you know, but it is. This is like Rwanda in 1994, where you had a minority ruling the country, been put in there by the Belgians forever, and then they turned, you know, then the majority turned against them. And this is what we're seeing in Syria, and it can be nothing but bloody. This is not to justify anything the regime is doing. I mean, destroying your own country is obviously not a solution, that you obviously lost the narrative if you think that that's going to save anybody. But I'm just explaining to you why a coup d'etat today would make absolutely no difference in Syria. You'd have these same generals fighting on and the delusion that they can hold back history. And it is a delusion. And under that sort of delusion, they're almost unstoppable. And I mean, not unstoppable, they are stoppable on military force, but they're not going to give up easily.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Syria, Iraq, and Lebanon. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. So what about the extent to which then it is a surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia? That was disputed by our earlier guest from Amnesty International, who feels that it's really a homegrown struggle. But clearly, the Iranians are supplying the Assad regime apparently with a fairly consistent stream of aircraft flying in over Iraq. Apparently, the president of the United States got on the phone with the Iraqi leader that we put in power, al-Maliki, who apparently ignored the president's pleas to stop these overflights, making one, of course, remember how the absolute folly of the neoconservatives who got us into that war, where clearly the only winner of the Iraq war were the Iranians. And then you've got the Saudis and the Qataris pouring arms in as well, even though our previous guest said that there's not much evidence of any modern weaponry. Everything that she's seen on the ground has been old Soviet stuff.
Oh, I think she's absolutely right. I mean, I've heard the same reports. It's all light arms, rocket-propelled grenades. It's stuff that's been looted. It's stuff that deserters have taken across. It's stuff that's come over the border from Lebanon. And what they clearly need to tip the balance is surface-to-air missiles and anti-tank weapons, which they're not getting. I don't think the Gulf states have a way to get in. I don't think the Turks want the war to ratchet up to that effect, and it's certainly not a surrogate war. It was spontaneous. It happened. It's from years of oppression that the majority rose. But the way the Gulf looks at it, the Gulf Arabs and the Iranians, is this is their war too. And Iran doesn't feel that it can lose Damascus in this greater war. And as I said, I was out in the Gulf talking to officials, and their worst nightmare is that something's not done about Tehran, whether it's in Syria or against Iran itself. They put it this way. They said, look, if Iran normalized relations with the United States in some grand bargain, you combine that with Iraq and add up their oil, total oil production. I think this is high, but this is the figures they use. It's 15 million barrels a day, which will dwarf the Arabs. And one day, the United States will wake up and say, why do we need the Arabs? Let's go with Iran and its satellite Iraq. This is the kind of thinking that is driving the royal families in the Gulf to put money into the Syrian conflict, keep it going, destroy Syria. It's almost a balancing act with having lost Iraq to Iran. And if they look, we lost Iraq, but we'll take Syria away from Iran, and we'll be even. And we'll take Lebanon away from Iran, and we'll be more than even. It's a very crude way of looking at things, but that's the way they look at it.
Well, of course, we witnessed Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel at the United Nations with a kind of strange sort of Wile E. Coyote drawing of a bomb, drawing a red line on this cartoonish bomb, suggesting, according to Netanyahu's own beliefs, that Iran will cross a red line in the spring, meaning that Israel will do something. So that's an odd, isn't that a real wild card here in this? If you've got Iran determined not to lose, the Saudis determined not to allow Iran and Iraq to replace them as the dominant oil suppliers, what is Israel up to?
I think they can't attack. They can't attack, yes, but it would do no good at all. It would only push the Iranians faster. It would justify their getting a bomb. in the world's eyes. You know, they would just go ahead and build it and test it. I think Israel knows that. The Israelis are not stupid. I think Bibi is scared the way the Middle East is going, this great shift of power, this hostility on his borders. This is all very fluid for them. But, and of course, look at it this way. You know, do we really need a third and fourth war in the Middle East now with the confusion? How long will it be before the Strait of Hormuz is closed? Our troops are tired. They've been fighting for 12 years now, something like that. And there's nobody to fight these wars anymore. Afghanistan, mark my words, the roof's going to blow off in 2 weeks. It's going to be a messy, messy end to our departure in 2014. We don't know what to do about Libya, what to do about sub-Saharan Africa, and this country, frankly, can't withstand a very large regional war, which will entail Iran. And I think the Israelis understand in their hearts the last thing they want to do is draw the United States into a really, you know, a truly crushing war that would bankrupt us if we got out of control. They don't want to do it. I think what Netanyahu wants to do is get the most concessions out of the United States as he can. Now, there are red lines to attacking Iran in Washington. I've heard one is that once the Iranians start simulating a nuclear bomb on a computer, that's really going to have to rethink things. But, you know, this is a total guess. And it's a piece of punditry that's probably worthless. But I think the Iranians like, you know, twisting the tail of the lion simply to get attention. The Iranians want us to believe they're going to make a bomb. It's a great negotiating tactic. They can go back to the table this spring after the elections here, say, all right, you know, the new president, you got 3 years. Here's the deal. We'll limit enrichment to 5%. We'll take anything enriched over and send it, you know, to Turkey to be, you know, all sorts of deals that could be worked out. So I think both Israel and Iran, and this is just a guess, are maneuvering for the post-election period.
You said a new president. I imagine a new term.
I don't know.
Well, I was going to say that
Obama's going to win.
I would have thought in the upcoming debates that there's no question that these questions will come up, will they not? And I would think that in a debate, given the hawkish views of Romney and reflecting those of McCain and others on the Republican side, that we should get into another war in Syria and another war perhaps against Iran, that Obama will have the stronger argument. Aren't the American people tired of these wars?
Oh, they're absolutely tired. There's nothing you can do. You know, if anybody starts blaming this administration for the mess in the Middle East, they don't get it. You know, there's nothing we can do about Yemen. I mean, look at a map. Look at the geography. You can't do anything about it. Or look at northern Mali or Niger or Algeria, which a lot of this stuff is coming out of. And look at the mess in Libya, not being able to get the FBI in because we couldn't send in a Marine division or whatever it would have taken to secure that consulate. I mean, if you don't get that, you don't get anything. Or the whole idea of sending 5 FBI agents with sidearms to retake the consulate is a fantasy. So I think that, you know, if we just, we can't be the Middle East police. We were never meant to be. We've taken sides with Israel, and that's based on not because of the lobby in this country, it's because this country is driven by ideology, and that's democracy and progress and the perfectibility of man. And Israel, more than any country in the Middle East, represents that ideal. And I think a lot of Americans say, hey, you know, these guys are, yeah, they've got their faults, but they're ultimately like us, and they can be, you know, pulled into the 21st century, and the other guys can't. So, you know, it's this ideology has met reality in the streets of Libya and the streets of Damascus, and it's time we just take a realistic foreign policy. And when people are ready to start, you know, joining us in the 21st century, we will help where we can. but we cannot police them into doing this. And it really shouldn't be a political issue at all. The Obama administration should have come out on day one and said this was an organized attack on that consulate. You know, the moment the news came out that the mortars had hit the consulate, the annex, it was clear it had to have been organized. You simply don't bring in mortars on the first shot unless you've got people that are very well trained and know what they're doing and have been surveying the consulate. It's just a fact. So I think that the fact that the Obama administration doesn't want to deal with a new al-Qaeda threat in Libya, totally understandable. And I'm going to be happy when this election is over and we can get to reality in the Middle East, which is getting out of Afghanistan, you know, dealing with Iran, reaching that grand bargain, and doing anything we can to suppress things like what's happening in Syria, but ultimately knowing we are not going to determine the outcome.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. He is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, A Husband and Wife True Life Spy Story. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of a new article about three possible options that Israel might use in the war against Iran, the Entebbe option, how the U.S. military thinks Israel might strike Iran.
I fell into a ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He's the recipient of both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award, and has an article at Foreign Policy, The Entebbe Option, How the U.S. Military Thinks Israel Might Strike Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Perry.
Good to be here, Ian. Thank you.
And the three options that you brought out in your article after extensive discussions with a lot of senior U.S. military officers, both current and former, are essentially option one, an Israeli commando raid on Iranian nuclear facilities, option two, a massive bombing campaign, and option three, a decapitation strike against Iranian leadership and its military and intelligence Praetorian Guard. I take it that of these options, none of them are mutually exclusive. They could be, you know, one, two, and three, right?
They could all, that's right. They could all go together. They could have an aerial bombardment with a commando raid and decapitation. And I would add that it doesn't appear to me that any of them will really work. They could all escalate into an all-out regional war. And it seems to me that it's likely that they would all result in the involvement of the United States and probably American casualties.
So given the apparent downside, which is, should be apparent to both Israel and certainly is apparent to U.S. Military officers, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, who's gone to great pains in public to say the U.S., they want to dissociate themselves from any Israeli action. And the very fact that we're talking about military options as though they're possible and therefore they're no longer secret would indicate to me that maybe there's a lot of kabuki going on here. This is a shadow play. What's your reading?
Well, I hope that's the case. I hope that this is all a big bluff and that the intention here is to frighten the Iranians into being more forthcoming diplomatically. But so far, at least, it's simply not working. And I think that all that Mr. Netanyahu has done is to frighten the American public and certainly his own public. And the Iranians are dragging their feet at the diplomatic negotiating table. The United States is seemingly not as worried as the Israelis, and it almost looks as if Mr. Netanyahu is trying to insert himself again into the America election. So, to be honest with you, I think we're stuck. Nothing seems to work. Rattling the swords doesn't work. Diplomacy isn't working. On the other hand, I suppose the good news is at least the Iranians are not moving any faster now than they were before towards gaining a nuclear weapon.
Well, I must say that Netanyahu's performance at the United Nations, a lot of people have described as bizarre with that sort of Wile E. Coyote cartoon of the bomb where he drew the red line with a Pentel pen and basically said that in the spring Iran's going to cross Netanyahu's red line, which I suppose is another way of saying there'll be war. But what's inherent in what Netanyahu's saying is that he, not the American president, is going to decide whether Americans' blood is going to be shed. I mean, to me, that's beyond chutzpah. He's really crossed the line here. If he thinks that he can decide when Americans shed their blood.
Well, that's how it sounds to the American military, at least to many officers with whom I've spoken. And it does cross a line in the Pentagon. No one has the right to determine when American blood is shed except for the president and senior military commanders. And I would amend that by saying simply the president of the United States and the U.S. Congress. It goes beyond the pale, and it's quite upsetting to military officers to have a Israeli prime minister pounding the table and saying, defend us, defend us, defend us, and not only that, but defend us on our terms and when we say that you should. We are in the midst of, or have been in the midst of, two major conflicts in the Middle East, in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our economy is quite shaky. We spent billions, if not trillions of dollars on these wars. There's no appetite that I can determine in this country, correct me if I'm wrong, for another war in the Middle East, certainly one that would drag on and drag our economy again down with it. So, I think that there is a growing disdain and discomfort with Israel's ability to do this again and again and again. And I think the American people, if they were to be asked quite bluntly, the vast majority of them would say that they want a diplomatic solution to this problem. They don't want another war in the region.
So would that also apply perhaps in the upcoming debates on Wednesday with Romney and Obama? It's pretty clear that Obama's trying to get us out of wars and Romney's trying to get us into wars.
Well, I think that's you're exactly right. But what I've noticed over the last 48 hours is the slow but certain backing up on the part of Mr. Romney, as he called Netanyahu after his speech at the United Nations, after Netanyahu's speech at the United Nations. But he did a very slow backpedal, congratulated him on his speech, but also to the press afterwards did a little tongue-in-cheek to make fun of Netanyahu's Wile E. Coyote cartoon, saying that it wasn't the result of the best Boston Consulting graphic, to say the least. I think that there's a sense in Israel now that this was a mistake, that this man is not taken seriously. There's a rethinking, I hope, among the Israeli leadership that perhaps they could lower the temperature on this. And Mr. Netanyahu has gone out of his way to say he has no intention of inserting himself in the American campaign. Of course, it's too late for that. He has. But still, I think we're going to see over the next week the lowering of the temperature on the war talk coming out of the Israeli government.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. He has an article at Foreign Policy, The Entebbe Option, How the U.S. Military Thinks Israel Might Strike Iran. Now, the U.S. military, CENTCOM, who are in charge of this region, they did a war game back in March dubbed Internal Look, which is about the very scenario that we're talking about. And the results are pretty sobering, aren't they? This has led a lot of generals, including the head of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin Dempsey, to basically go on the record saying that they want no part of a war with Iran.
Well, that's exactly right. My information is that at first, that is to say, a couple of years ago now, the naval component of the Central Command was pretty... I don't want to say arrogant, but pretty confident that they would be able to take on the Iranians without too many problems. And when they thought through the premises of a war game, it became very sobering to them. They realized that they were going to have more problems than they thought, and that the Iranians would be able to take out one of their ships, at the very least a destroyer, perhaps more, and that a conflict with the Iranians in the Persian Gulf could be quite costly. And since that initial assessment, and as a result of the war game that you mentioned, Internal Look, which took place 6 months ago, the U.S. military, and particularly the U.S. Navy, have kind of woken up to the fact that this is going to be, if there's a conflict, it's going to be a pretty tough go. Now, in the immediate aftermath of that war game 6 months ago, General Mattis, the head of CENTCOM, asked for another aircraft carrier. It was denied to him by President Obama, who's very conservative about these things, but he asked for another aircraft carrier because he's going to need it. So, you know, this idea that we can just simply go to war and that it'll be over quickly and that no one's a match for us, we need to discard that idea. If there's a conflict in the Persian Gulf with Iran, it's going to be major, it's going to be prolonged, it's going to be costly. I don't think there's any question we'll win in the end, but it's not going to be easy at all. This isn't going to be Grenada. It's going to be a major conflict and very costly, and it's going to cost American lives, and that's what's giving people like Martin Dempsey real pause.
Well, I think, didn't a third aircraft carrier get deployed? I mean, these are huge targets, and if the U.S. were to lose a capital ship like its nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, that would be traumatic, and that took about a red line.
Yeah, that's right. A third aircraft carrier is on the way. The loss of an aircraft carrier would be catastrophic. And I think that if a war were to come, as one of my military officers, and I quote him in the article, said, all bets are off. We just don't know when a war comes what's going to happen. The Iranians are very dedicated, very well armed. They have good plans. They know what we're going to do. We know what they're going to do. We're well armed. They're well armed. They've been planning for this for a long time. We have too. We shouldn't underestimate them. They're very patriotic. They're very dedicated. This isn't one in and one out. I hate to repeat myself, but it's not Grenada. You know, the Israelis, I think, sometimes act as if this can be done in a day. It can't be done in a day. It would take us 90 days of a sustained bombing campaign to knock down their air force and keep them on the ground and to get to their nuclear sites. And I'm not the one who says this. Every major study that's been done on this says that the only thing we could possibly do would be to interdict their nuclear sites and to postpone their nuclear program by 4 years. We wouldn't be able to end it. So the best hope I think we have is the course that President Obama has set us on, which is the hope for a diplomatic solution and talking to them and being serious about them and keeping the pressure on and bringing them to the table. There isn't really a good military solution here.
Well, just in closing, our previous guest, former CIA officer Robert Baer, was saying he just came back from the Gulf where he's been meeting with high officials there. And he said that what's really going on in this surrogate war between Iran and the Saudis in the Gulf, particularly in Syria, is this fear on the part of the Sunni Arabs in the Gulf that with combining Iraq and Iran's oil, they have the capacity to outproduce the Saudis, and that this is the great fear, that, in other words, our stupid neocons and George Bush and Rice and Rumsfeld and Cheney essentially gave Iraq over at the cost of enormous American blood and treasure to Iran, and that is, they were in at the end of the day, this is about oil.
Bob Baer is exactly right. This was unimaginably stupid. What's shocking to me is that we don't talk about it that often. You know, this is recent history. We ought to be able to remember just how badly we screwed this up. We now have, you know, allied a country that we need not have allied with Iran and provided a pool of oil to an enemy of ours. And in the name of what? And now we've got allies of ours, like Saudi Arabia, very worried, and we're in the process of picking a military solution when we ought to be picking a diplomatic solution, and having a country of 6 million people in Israel getting us into a conflict that could sink our economy. I think it's a very dangerous time. Our military believes it's a very dangerous time, and our best choice here is to let diplomacy work. I hope that that's the choice we make.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here, Mark Perry.
Thank you. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, A Fire in Zion, and most recently, Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He's the recipient of both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award, and has an article at Foreign Policy, The Entebbe Option, How the U.S. Military Thinks Israel Might Strike Iran. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And the conversation continues on Facebook / Ian Masters Media. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared.